Well, a very personal question. How do you think you have changed during the course of this trial? We can get into the more legalistic aspects of the trial a little bit later on in the interview, but while you're here, I'd like to get some ideas as to how you think you've changed or grown during the course of the trial as a person.
I've changed considerably. I've learned an awful lot about women's liberation, for example, that I did not know or have any real sympathy for. I've also learned how people can work together in an inexhaustible fashion to produce material, to publicize a case, to politicize it, to reach people, and I've watched that develop under the staff here. I've also learned that I am very much inclined to communal living and to the type of life where you do share your life with other people, that the going home at 5 o'clock to an isolated home which contains only one family unit is going to be very hard for me to resume. I would rather come home, I think, to a great many people living communally and having a sharing experience of that sort. I don't know whether at my age that's even possible any longer, but I have learned to like that very much and to be stimulated by it. I also have learned you can work like a bastard all day long into the night, and that get up the next morning and still go through an exhausting day in court and feel exhilarated and stimulated by this type of contact, not just by the legalities of the case, but by the contact with the defendants, their girls, their wives, their mothers, their friends, the people that drop in off the street and want to work. And this creates a possibility in my mind that maybe a life can be molded in this fashion. I'm sure it's too late for me, but I think for many of the people that have passed through this trial, that it is a working possibility that such a type of existence, which has all these communal benefits, could be on a more or less permanent basis after the trial itself breaks up.
You mentioned sort of almost prophetically in a sense that you were going home after the trial. Do you think, in fact, that will happen? What was the judge's constant reminders that you're likely to be on trial yourself once this case is over?
No, I think there'll be lots of problems, but I'm thinking in very conventional terms of bail systems and so on, and the fact that I have other professional responsibilities to H.Rapp Brown in many places and other defendants, that I will probably be practicing for some time before, assuming the worst, I have to serve time for what the judge considers condemnatious conduct in this case. But I thought you were going to mention something else. I'm not sure where my home is anymore, because I've come to regard Chicago as a home. And I think that I will miss the city, people I've met and worked with. And for me to say home is Mamaroneck, New York, is still very difficult.
What could you go into, Bill, some of the examples of the kind of conduct that the judge has cited thus far on the record as contumacious?
Well, he has taken every sharp exchange as contumacious. For example, at one time, the judge said, in answer to a question of mine, that why we had to come a half hour earlier on a Saturday when we were working one day later a week, that the answer was because. And I retorted that that was what a child answers when he's asked a difficult question. And then he intoned, let the record show that in the presence of the jury, the defense counsel called the trial judge a baby. That kind of thing is what's in the record. There have been many sharp exchanges, most of them having to do with unfair treatment by the judge as alleged by the defendants and their counsel. And he has said on many occasions that we would have to answer for that later. That was condemnatious conduct, and we would have in the future to answer for it in his court or some other court. I think in the main, I don't think if I went back over the trial, I would do any differently. These were hot exchanges in a heartfelt case where the stakes are high, not for the defendant so much in jail time, though that's high enough, but for the country as a whole. And I thought under those circumstances, I had to be more aggressive in the courtroom than I had ever been in my life.
Did you feel hampered in any way along the trial? What with the judge constantly referring to the possibilities of contempt citations after the end of the trial, in putting forth the kind of defense that you would like to put forth during the course of the trial?
Yeah, I think we were greatly hampered. One of our main defeats, of course, was not being able to put the Attorney General, or the former Attorney General of the United States, on the stand, whom we thought had relevant testimony and who himself thought had relevant testimony. He was intensely upset when he left here after being refused even to testify in the presence of the jury, after a screening process, which is the first time that I've ever heard of such being exercised with a willing witness. I thought his testimony would have been telling for us and very important, but he was prevented from so doing, and I think that was a body blow to us. There have been many other areas we've tried to explore, illustrating the motive and intent of the clients, like racism in the United States and poverty and other areas, the war for which they came to Chicago in the first place, where he has blocked us completely.
So in other words, the jury doesn't even have a full picture of with which to go in and deliberate at the end of the trial. They just have bits and snatches and perhaps what the marshals might communicate to them in the witness room, in the jury room at some point or another. What do you think, Bill, were the high spots during the course of this trial in terms of witnesses, in terms of drama, just in terms of general feeling of accomplishment during the course of the trial?
Well, in terms of witnesses, I thought we had a great many high spots, and without in any way derogating the witnesses whom I don't mention, I thought Allen Ginsberg was an extreme high point of the case. Because there a man got on the stand and by his own strength of character and his own strength of endeavor, let the jury know what he's all about. And I thought Judy Collins was another one of those moments when she recited and really as only a fine actress could do, "Where Have All the Flowers Gone?" I thought that the arrest of the lawyers in the beginning was one of the high points of the case, and the judges being forced to back down, both by probably pressure on him from sources I don't know, but also from the fact that 200 lawyers came here to protest what happened with those contempt charges. I thought Bobby Seale's binding and gagging, of course, was one of the tragic high spots of the trial, and maybe that did more to show the American public what was going on in the courtroom than anything else. There have been so many witnesses for us, over 125, I guess, by now, that I would be hard-pressed just to fit each one in. But I do remember Ginsberg so well and Judy Collins so well. There have been others like Jane Meyerdink, the little Quaker girl, who was beautiful on the stand, and Sarah Diamond, the photographer, who described in really simple but eloquent prose what had happened to her, that it would serve no useful purpose to go through them all. It's just been a case with one highlight after another. Bobby Seale returning to take the stand, and even though he said some hard things and had to be interrogated on a very rough speech he made here, it was good. It was a unity of political forces, and he said what he had to say, and the jury has to be confronted with that as well as with any other of our witnesses.
Bill, what do you think will happen with future political, major political cases like this one? Do you think that the trying of these eight men is in some way symbolic of the attempts that the government will engage in the future to crush the anti-war movement, the peace movement, the black liberation movement, and the rapidly emerging women's liberation movement? Do you think they'll engage in these kinds of trials in the future, given the kinds of defenses and the kinds of attempts that the defendants in this case tried to present before the court, or do you think they'll use some other kinds of tactics?
Well, I think what happens in this case may be the gauge as to what happens in the future. I think what has happened in this case may be the gauge. If all political cases are fought this way, then I think it may be one weapon to strike back against a government that chooses its own battlefield. If we have to go into their battlefield, then it's got to be a real battlefield and has to be exploited to the fullest. And I think that this trial has been exploited to the fullest. I think that's one method that we may have. There may come a day when we say no courts at all, no lawyers, no courts, and that isn't the way we handle our problems. But while we're still in it, I think that the system here is amenable for the moment to this type of an approach. And I think that how this case comes out may well determine how future cases come out or how they're approached.
What kind of approach did the prosecution use in this case, Bill?
Very straight approach. They just put on a flock of police witnesses whose sole end was to show that the defendants or the people like the defendants were people who used fuck every other word and who had lifestyles that were different from middle America, such as smoking marijuana openly, having sex lives which were far freer than the kind of repressed middle class countenances, from not shrinking from questioning every value of the society, including mostly the value of money as a measuring rod. And these policemen took the stand and tried to show that all of these things were true, and then tried to add to it the element of violence. That coupled with all of this, all of the type of strange life, according to contemporary standards, that these defendants or people like them had, they also would not stoop to, or they would stoop to using violent methods to overthrow the society so that they could establish their own. That's the kind of case I think they try to present.
And how would you classify the response of the defendant's case to the government's very straight case?
Well, it's been on, I guess, two levels. One level, of course, is to rebut what the government said they did by showing witnesses to show there really wasn't the defendants at all or their people, but the police who did all the dirty work. And then the second level was to show the lifestyle of the defendants. All ranges from an Allen Ginsberg to a Timothy Leary to a Staunton Lynn to a Congressman Conyers and so on, to show all stages of their life, the people they associate with, the people that work with them, the type of life they live, and so on, and to try to educate the jury that that life doesn't necessarily mean that they are bad or violent people.
Bill, do you think that the government will utilize this anti-riot law again to prosecute other people?
I think that depends, Mickey, on what happens here. If there's a hung jury, I think it may be a long time before they use it again. Or they will select very carefully the people they use it again so that they won't get a congealed, solid political mass against them.
What are your hopes for appeal? That's usually the traditional lawyer's approach. I know I'm not attributing that to you at all, but there are a number of lawyers in this community who have said that hopes for appeal are very great and that we shouldn't worry about what happens on the district court level because, of course, we can always go to the Court of Appeals or to the Supreme Court for that matter. What are your thoughts on that?
I think it's very true. There's a lot of error in the record, I think. I could be wrong, but I think there's so much in the record that should we lose here, I think there would be enough grounds to sink a ship with. How many will be sustained depends on what's the composition of the appellate courts and how the country turns, because the courts are themselves governed by what goes on around them in the political world and not strictly by legal precedents. So I think they're good, but who knows?
Is one last question, Bill, is what happened in the courtroom here in Chicago, you think just a sort of one-shot kind of thing, or do you think that Judge Hoffman's court is pretty much like all courts in this country?
In one way, it's like all courts. The judge has all the power, and the judge controls things pretty closely. In another sense, it's rather unique, because he's a unique man. He is an extremely bright man who just can't really bend to some of the things going around him. He's 74 or 5 years old, and suddenly he's confronted with this whole strange antithesis to his whole life. And I think it's very difficult for him to take, so it has caused an abrasive reaction, which I think has resulted in much of the stuff you asked in your last question about error in the record.
Leonard, could you tell us what the defendants in this case are being tried for?
Yes, this is the first federal trial whereby persons are being charged for having a certain state of mind as they cross a state line. Up to this time, a federal crime could only consist of passing an identifiable object or person over a state line. Such as the Racketeering Act, which makes it a crime to pass certain weapons and implements of the racketeering trade across a state line. The Mann Act, of course, involves the passing of a female across state line for immoral purposes. But this is the first crime involving crossing a state line with a state of mind. And technically the charge is crossing a state line with a state of mind intending to incite, promote, or encourage a riot, which in this particular statute is defined as a gathering of three persons, any one of whom threatens or commits injury upon a fourth person or threatens and commits property damage upon a fourth person.
And that's the legal definition of what they're being tried for. Do you think it goes beyond that?
Well, of course, I think in the course of this trial, if anyone has had any doubts about the reason for their being indicted and tried under this case, that doubt would have been resolved once you became familiar with the government's case. For instance, they have introduced into evidence to prove a state of mind speeches made by Rennie Davis in November of 1967, approximately 5.5 months before this law was even enacted. Speeches made by Tom Hayden before the law became enacted by Congress. And all of these speeches have to do with anti-war activities. Rennie Davis spoke to the Cadre, which is a resistance group in Chicago, on that date. It's clear that the defendants were selected and indicted as a group representing the entire spectrum of social protest and dissent in the country. Indictments are usually handed down with the defendants named in alphabetical order. That was not the case in this case. The government first named in the indictment David Dellinger, pacifist, then named the two New Left and anti-war leaders Tom Hayden and Rennie Davis, the two Yippie founders, Jerry Rubin and Abby Hoffman, two members representing campus, radical campus protest and dissent, Lee Weiner and John Freund, and finally naming Bobby Seale from the Black Liberation Movement as chairman of the Black Panther Party. So they encompassed in the indictment the entire spectrum of New Left, Black dissent, and anti-war dissent in the country.
So in other words, they're being prosecuted not only for their political views, but in the case of Abby and Jerry, certainly for their lifestyles as well.
Absolutely. There's no question about that. The government has made frequent allusion in the course of the trial to the way the defendants behave, the way they look, the way they conduct themselves, and the way they looked and conducted themselves here in Chicago during the convention 68.
Leonard, does this trial, in a way, represent a new kind of thrust in terms of political trials that you see coming up, let's say, in the next 2, 3, 6 months, a year?
Well, I think there will be political trials in the next year, but I think this trial, I think, is indicated to the government that this type of political prosecution doesn't work. I think they and most of the people who've observed this trial think that the government has lost substantially by initiating this case, regardless of the outcome. I think political trials in the future will be marijuana possession, the type of crimes that are usually prosecuted against the Black Panthers. I just don't think the government is going to again run the risk of a blatant, outright political trial, which will gain the support of the traditional liberal establishment, such as this trial has. From now on, I think it's going to be pot, assaults, possession of weapons, etc. Those will be political, maybe even more political than this case, but I think it's going to be more difficult for the defendants in those cases, because you just will not attract the attention that this case has as a political trial.
What kind of defense have the defendants and the lawyers in this case been attempting to put forth in the courtroom, and do you think you've been allowed to utilize the kind of defense you would have liked to have used in the courtroom?
Well, considering the nature of the charge against us, the rulings of the court, conduct of the prosecution, we've been able to get before the jury and into the court a considerable amount of evidence. We've planned the defense jointly, all the defendants participating in the planning of it. We've called over 100 witnesses. We've demonstrated our lifestyle, our politics before the jury. I'm satisfied that the defense that was presented is a fair representation of the political and social positions of the defendants. And if we're found guilty, we have no qualms about not being able to fully present ourselves in the courtroom. I think we've been able to do that fairly successfully.
Leonard, have you found that your experience in this trial has been considerably different from your experiences in other trials? As a lawyer, have you had a kind of special role to play, not just as a legal expert, but as kind of a political spokesman as well for the defendants?
Well, the one thing, of course, that immediately was different and that makes everything else different is that I don't live in Chicago, so like most of the defendants, I came here, and I've had to establish living here, which I did with some of the defendants. And I've never before lived with a client, or I cannot really call it clients, I've never before lived together with people while I'm going through a courtroom experience. And living together, working together, having conferences in the kitchen and the bedroom rather than in an office, conferring constantly with the people you represent as a team is clearly different than any other type of trial work I've done. And that has made it more political for myself personally. And that's completely personalized the experience in the way that attorneys don't frequently have the opportunity of being involved. So it has been different from that point on.
Well, you and Bill Kunstler have been accused of a number of things, both in and out of the courtroom, by the legal profession and in some instances in the courtroom by the prosecution attorneys, accused of being mouthpieces, accused of being unprofessional. Do you find that this kind of unnerves you a bit?
No, most of it is really quite flattering. I think most professional attorneys who I talk to object to the fact that the defendants in this case have played such an active role in the preparation and the delivery of the defense. I take that as a compliment. I think, in a sense, their feelings about their own profession as being a kind of a technical elite position is exposed when they criticize this trial. I think most of them object to the fact that it's a team effort, that that the people who are on trial have as much say about what happens in the courtroom as the attorneys. And frankly, I think the profession finds that threatening.
Along with that, Lynn, there are obviously possibilities of contempt citations for not only for the defendants, but for the lawyers in the case as well. Could you give some of your ideas about that?
I think that the court apparently intends to impose contempt citations on Bill Kunstler and myself. Bill and I both take the position that we will not even think about this in the course of the trial. We haven't. Obviously, the intent of the court is to intimidate us with these threats, and if you plan around them and think about them, I think you're just playing into their hands. The judge remarked yesterday to Bill Kunstler, "You're a very brave man to continue in the face of my continuous citations of contempt for you." And that was a recognition on the part of the trial judge that no matter how many times he attempts to cite contumacious conduct, which it isn't, that Bill has continued and myself to some extent to actively pursue the defense in the face of that. And we can't take time to think about it. We'd just be knuckling under and playing into their hands.
Lynn, what do you think, what are your predictions for the outcome of the trial? Do you think that the evidence that's been presented thus far by the prosecution and the defense had some kind of impact on the jury, or do you think they already pretty much made up their minds from the first day they were in court? Just in general, how does the evidence weigh on the jurors, and what do you think the role of the judge will be in somewhat hampering or hamstringing the jury in trying to bring back, for instance, a verdict of acquittal or, for that matter, a hung jury?
Well, we anticipate the judge, through his charge of the jury, will indicate quite clearly that the law is a very narrow, technical one, and that given the evidence that the government has presented, the jury should have little difficulty in reaching a verdict of guilt. I optimistically feel that there are at least several persons on that jury who will disagree with the position taken by the court in its instruction. There's no real basis for being able to predict an outcome like in most criminal cases, but we have a very difficult statute to deal with. We are dealing with a very difficult court. We have a prosecutor who at every step of the way has attempted to inflame and prejudice the jury against us. But in spite of all that, I still think that there is a hope that at least several, if not more, of the jurors will see through all of that, will understand the nature and the type of prosecution that's being directed against us, and will feel that it's part of their civic duty to not permit, not be a party to the erosion of the judicial process that's going on before their very eyes.
What do you think were the ramifications to the case, to the defendants, to the movement in general, to the severance of Bobby from this case?
Bobby, of course, was in Chicago at the time of the convention for approximately 16 hours, during which time he made one formal speech and a short impromptu speech in front of the Hilton Hotel before a very small gathering. Neither speech, of course, resulted in violence. As a matter of fact, both speeches, which have been taped and we have, were characterized more by an audience reaction that was jocular, that was good-humored, a lot of applause. Bobby, who himself was once a stand-up comedian, is a great tactician as a speaker. And as he said in the stand this morning, when he came into Lincoln Park, he had a very strong sense of the fact the park was under occupation, with the feeling that people in the park were in danger, including himself. And Bobby handled himself accordingly. To most lawyers, it's a complete mystery that he's in this case. He did not know a single defendant in August of 1968. He did not even know he was coming to Chicago until approximately 4 or 5 hours before he boarded a plane. Eldridge Cleaver was supposed to come as a speaker for the Peace and Freedom Party. When Eldridge couldn't make it, I believe Kathleen was supposed to come. Last minute, when she could make it, Bobby agreed to come in their place, and he flew out here. It's obvious that they put Bobby into the case for the reasons which I've indicated earlier in the interview. The government also attempts to characterize Bobby before the jury time and time again as a violent person. If Bobby would stand in the early part of this trial and respectfully standing right at his seat, asking for the right to cross-examine a witness because his attorney was in the hospital, the judge would characterize that statement on the record as a violent outburst. It would be carried in the press and reported as being a violent outburst. It was Kafkaesque, sitting there and watching this whole process of a build-up and a change of a man's character taking place by virtue of statements by the judge and the prosecutor, with perhaps the most gentle man in the courtroom being the victim of it all. Something which the press has overlooked, and I keep trying to remind them, is that on the first day of the trial, When the judge entered the courtroom, the defendants, in protest to the authority of the court, refused to rise, all except for Bobby Seale, who constantly took the position that the court was to be shown respect, although not the institution which backed it up. For him to ultimately be in a position where he's chained and gagged required this whole change in atmosphere brought about by the government and the judge. And to sit there as a lawyer and to see this take place, not in a precinct house, not where these types of actions usually take place, but in a federal district court, was probably the most trying time I've had as a lawyer.
Len, assuming that the jury isn't going to be allowed to commit an act of civil disobedience by returning a verdict of not guilty, what do you expect the chances for the defendants are on appeal? What with the new Supreme Court appointments and so on?
Yeah, every lawyer I talk to glibly says the defendants will win the case on appeal. And I think there's no question but that there's ample error in the record. However, if people will study the history of appeals and political trials, they might be somewhat dismayed by what they find. So I'm not that optimistic. I frankly am more optimistic in front of the jury. I'm more hopeful in front of a jury, and I would prefer, of course, to win this case before a jury. Because given the law that's being applied against them, the court and the prosecution, if the government cannot get a conviction in this case, then I think that more or less proves the point that we've been trying to make throughout this trial, and that is that this is a gross perversion of justice by the government.